Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
From NPR. You can now watch your garden glow with new genetically modified bioluminescent petunias.
Ooh.
Mm.
So we have one Keith Wood. Yes, that's his real name, PhD, to thank for this. And he spent most of his career in pharmaceutical research in molecular and chemical biology.
Huh.
And he used his work with bioluminescence to understand how molecules interacted with diseases. He started this work as a grad student when the team he was on put a firefly gene into a tobacco plant. It was not something, you know, a consumer would buy, but it was good for understanding pathways within an organism. And now, today, about 40 years after that first plant, Wood and his company, LightBio, they are marketing a garden petunia that glows in the dark, and they are calling it the firefly petunia.
So this is something I can buy. Like, I could plant this in my yard.
Oh, yeah. You better believe I have already placed a pre-order. They are shipping right now.
Like, I'm not into gardening, but I would plant those. I'd give those a try.
Absolutely. I mean, that's kind of sort of the point here. The quote it opens with him is, "People don't think about science as just bringing joy to our lives. We thought we could do something really special here, bring in a kind of magic into our lives." And so the way it works, it's, you know, during the day, it's a petunia. It's got bright white flowers. Looks like something that you would get at a garden center right now. But when the lights are turned out or it gets dark, the petals slowly start lighting up with a greenish white glow. And here's the thing, the plant is always glowing. It's just our eyes that need to adjust to see the light. And yeah, despite the name, plant doesn't have any fly or fly genes. They took four genes from a bioluminescent mushroom and a fifth from a fungi. So The first gene takes a metabolite and turns it into what they're saying is an intermediate. The second gene takes that intermediate, turns it into the actual fuel for the luminescence. And the third gene is what actually makes the light. Finally, that fourth gene takes the product from the light reaction, recycles it back to the starting point. They don't actually talk about what the fifth from the fungi is, so I'm guessing it's totally benign, definitely not a world domination play. As far as how long it took to actually get this to market, 10 years, folks, a full decade, to go from development to approval from the USDA, and that just happened last fall.
Wow.
The executive director of the National Garden Bureau says petunias are a guaranteed bestseller. They tend to be fairly easy to grow. They're often used as the spiller in the thriller, filler, spiller combo. Guess who took up gardening during the pandemic? Anyway, highly recommend as a hanging basket that you can bring inside if it gets too hot, but they still need their sun.
It is interesting that they took a very old-fashioned plant.
Well, tastes definitely change. There may have also been something about the petunia that made it genetically favorable for this kind of thing. Like, the minute somebody does a rose that glows in the dark in addition to smelling good, like, game over, right?
Or a tree, an entire tree.
Oh.
Yeah, well, this is not the first GMO plant, right? Like, so 7 years ago, an orange petunia that was modified with a maize gene, it showed up in gardens and nurseries in Europe and the U.S., however, the plant was never supposed to leave a closed lab, yet somehow it ended up in a lot of gardens. And regulators, they had to ask people to destroy the plants and seeds.
And I'm sure they all did.
Yeah.
So it's about $40.
For a seeds or for a sprouted plant?
For a sprouted plant.
Okay.
They don't want to sell you the seeds now. Come on, because that's how you propagate an empire. And there are so many warnings that you cannot propagate this. You are not allowed to resell this.
Yeah, try and stop me. That's what I would say.
Over my dead petunia.
That's
okay,
right.
Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from TheGuardian.com. It's titled, "Vietnamese Property Tycoon sentenced to death in $27 billion fraud case.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So, Truong Mai Lan, the chair of the developer Van Tin Phat, was found guilty of embezzlement, bribery, and violations of banking rules on Thursday in a case that has shocked the country.
Oof.
A total of $12.5 billion was embezzled, the equivalent of almost 3% of Vietnamese gross domestic product.
Oh, wow.
That is a scale for serious.
And I mean, you know, if you commit a murder, even just one, but especially multiple, you can find a death sentence here.
Right.
And there is also actuarial calculations on the value of a human life. So if you kind of tied those two concepts together a little bit too eagerly, you could say, well, $12.5 billion, how many human beings is that?
The
you know?
Biggest serial killer in history is what she is.
Well, yeah.
It's a good thing we don't have any kind of computational power to make those kinds of quantum leaps.
Yeah, we definitely do. They have those tables.
yeah. Which is not to say, you know, that I think about the world in that way necessarily or anything like that. But when you're talking about the scale of damage and economic fraud that happens, it's just about musical chairs of billionaires. You have too many. If you don't sit down on time or you commit fraud, off to the other chair.
Exactly.
Sorry.
Just ask Martha Stewart, you know?
A little brutal.
Oh, wow.
Anyways, so the verdict at the trial in Ho Chi Minh City read, "The defendant's actions eroded people's trust in the leadership of the Communist Party and state."
Mm.
The trial is part of a national corruption crackdown led by the Secretary General of the Communist Party of Vietnam, Nguyen Phu Trong. The campaign, which is also known as Blazing Furnace and has increased in recent years, has led to the indictment of thousands of people, as well as the resignation of two presidents and two deputy prime ministers.
Wait a minute. So you don't need to drain the swamp. You just need to burn it to the ground.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of gas in there. Just light a match, right? So Lan, who was arrested in October 2022, had denied the charges. A relative told Reuters before the verdict that she would appeal. And the death sentence is an unusually severe punishment for a corruption case. State media reported last week that Lan told the court she had joined the banking industry without sufficient experience and blamed a lack of understanding of legal matters. She said she had thought of death in desperation and asked the court for leniency for her husband, a Hong Kong businessman, and niece who were on trial as accomplices. Documents related to the trial kept in 105 boxes weighed 6 tons, according to VN Express, which reported the authorities had installed security cameras and fire safety equipment to protect the evidence ahead of the hearings.
They didn't just keep it in the bathroom?
Although Lan did not directly hold executive power at SCB, she owned 91.5% of the bank's shares through third parties and shell companies.
Wait a minute. If she owned 91% of it, wasn't she just like raiding her own piggy bank?
Well, you know, it gets worse from there.
Yeah, I assume the bank is getting money from the government. And that's what she's siphoning.
So she was accused of setting up fake loan applications to withdraw money from the bank over a period of 11 years from 2012 to 22. The loans accounted for 93% of the total credit the bank has issued, according to state media, which is wow. I mean, that's like literally you don't have a bank. You have her.
A petty cash empire.
Yeah.
Wow.
So to cover up the fraud, Lan and other SCB bankers were accused of giving state officials $5.2 million, the largest bribe ever recorded in Vietnam. The money was handed over in styrofoam boxes. Do Thi Nhan, a former chief banking inspector at the State Bank of Vietnam, said during the trial. Nhan said that after realizing the boxes contained money, she refused the boxes, but that Lan declined to take them back.
Hot potato.
Yeah. Since 2021, thousands of people have been indicted for corruption in the country in what analysts have described as the most comprehensive anti-corruption effort in the history of the Communist Party of Vietnam. Evaluating public sentiment in Vietnam, a one-party state, is challenging, but social media comments suggested many were shocked by the scale of the scandal. Giang said, "The case might indirectly signal that the state hasn't really been doing well in terms of managing the system, and also the state is incapable of controlling their own public officials."
Ooh. It's kind of fascinating as well, I think, to hear all of these crimes being listed as crimes, not because they're wrong, but because they damage the reputation of the state.
Yeah. doesn't make us look good, so now we have to do something about it.
Right. Now we're going to have to kill you. Sorry.
Yeah.
Right. There's the line. It's not that it's unethical. It's that you made us look bad.
Yeah.
Well, that's what you get for styrofoam containers. If she'd brought nice boxes, you know, a nice ribbon, a little bottle of wine with it, yeah, maybe she'd gotten away with it.
I mean, even just cardboard. You know, why styrofoam? That's weird.
Opaque and weatherproof, right?
All right, just bring in some beer. Just bring in some beer for the party.
Pack them at the bottom of the icer, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. She doesn't care about the environment either, guys. Give her the chair. Come on. Yeah.
Next link.
Next link.
Well, this next post definitely relates because this is from SciPost. Physically attractive attorneys tend to have greater success in federal court. So let's hope she finds a really hot attorney.
Too late. She didn't.
She didn't. For the appeal. Unsurprisingly, attorneys who are considered more physically attractive are more likely to win their cases and receive favorable votes from judges. These findings suggest that despite efforts to maintain fairness, judges might still be swayed by the appearance of attorneys. And as a son of a lawyer and a judge, it doesn't suggest it is.
See, now I'm just trying to question whether you're saying your parents are hot or not. Like,
No. I'm saying he judges appearance like crazy.
Right.
Yeah. The investigation into the impact of an attorney's attractiveness on judicial systems stems from the long recognized human bias, the, quote, beauty is good stereotype. Though the topic has been studied, its effects within the judiciary a little less so. To what extent an outside factor like attractiveness affects legal decision making raises significant concerns about the fairness of the judicial system. And I know fairness of a judicial system is an oxymoron, but it's not supposed to be.
Right.
So how do you establish this link? It's a bit tricky. The study employed sophisticated matching algorithms to pair attorneys who were equivalent in all aspects except for their level of attractiveness. Waterbury, the assistant research director for the Center for State Policy and Leadership, first compiled a set of attorneys who orally argue cases within the United States Courts of Appeals between 2017 and 2019. He chose the Courts of Appeals for his study due to the impartial assignment process of cases. It's all random.
Hmm.
The researcher then employed four distinct measures of attractiveness. And I know attractiveness is a bit subjective.
I'm just thinking of them feeding headshots from a website through their own version of like an internal Tinder.
That's exactly what they did in their first technique.
Wait, what?
Wow.
Yeah, I was going to say, first employed by Facebook when it was called Hot or Not,
uh-huh.
A survey evaluating attorneys' professional photos obtained from their websites were rated on a scale of 1 to 10. Second, and my least favorite, they used AI designed by Meg V or Meg 7, I'm not sure, VII, which analyzed symmetry and other elements that I'm sure are IP.
Mm-hmm.
Third, they used video clips of attorneys' oral arguments before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, capturing the dynamic aspects of attractiveness.
Mm.
And lastly, it rated the two opposing lawyer scores against each other. He analyzed over 3,000 judicial votes and 1,000 cases. Waterbury found that attorneys perceived as more attractive consistently enjoyed higher success rates.
Mm.
Female attorneys with higher attractiveness scores appeared to receive a greater advantage, especially when arguing before male judges.
Mm-hmm.
But there was little evidence that race or gender significantly influenced the attractiveness advantage.
That's something.
That's a small win.
You know, all right.
Yeah. Waterbury was surprised by the findings, but I'm not. Hot is hot. Also, it should be noted that one of the primary limitations is that the study focused on the United States Court of Appeals, specifically cases involving the U.S. government as a party.
Mm.
So the question is, does this then also apply to lower courts?
Mm.
They're setting up experiments now to see if it can be generalized. And I repeat what I said earlier as the son of a judge. Yes, it definitely you can generalize this stuff. So how David Comey, he must just be really good at print. Sorry, that's a local joke nobody else is going to get.
Oh, that's the dreadlocks guy.
Yes,
that's the dreadlock attorney.
I know him. He's the lawyer that rocks. Come on.
Exactly.
That's right.
And I've always wondered how, knowing what I know about judges, did he win cases?
Yeah.
And my assumption has been he's a master of paperwork.
Could be. Or he may not win. I mean, he's got billboards, which means he needs clients. So maybe he's not actually doing that great. He's just
one out of three. And since he's a plaintiff's attorney, that pays for it all.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, that's true. Sorry. Next link.
Next link.
All right. From SmithsonianMag.com, we have a heartwarming little piece called The Town That Kept Its Nuclear Bunker a Secret for 3 Decades.
Oh.
Heartwarming.
We'll get there.
Nuclear radiation warming?
Yeah. So, buried in the mountains in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, there is a very fancy place called the Greenbrier Resort. It opened in 1778 and has served as a getaway for the rich, and most especially rich politicians and their diplomatic guests, ever since. And it's very much a tourist economy in this tiny little town. The Greenbrier is by far the largest employer in the area, and locals pride themselves on being multi-generational employees of the resort, going back to great-grandparents and beyond. So there's a lot of loyalty. It's a very tight-knit community. And in 1958, when construction crews broke ground on a new wing of the resort, everybody pretty much saw right away that this was something weird. And they all just silently agreed that no one was going to talk about it.
No.
Because what they were building was pretty clearly a nuclear bunker. The hole went 720 feet deep, there were concrete trucks coming in day and night, and people saw the crews unloading things like a 25-ton steel blast door.
Ah.
And, you know, also part of the reason they understood what they were looking at was the overall mindset of the 1950s. You know, this was right in the middle of the Cold War, kids were watching duck and cover videos at school, families were being encouraged to build bomb shelters in their backyards and stock up on Spam and Geiger counters. And the people of Greenbrier also understood, you know, we're about 4 hours away from D.C. There's politicians here all the time. This is probably like where the president and his family are going to hide when the time comes. So it's actually really important that we don't talk about this. Because number one, Soviet spies could be anywhere. And number two, if people do find out this is where the presidential bunker is, they're going to bomb our little town to smithereens.
Or that's where the people who want to also live will go.
Right. They're thinking maybe they get in too as locals. Yeah. So it really did work. This was a secret that the whole town knew, but nobody ever talked about it. And their guess was a little bit off because the bunker wasn't for the president. JFK actually had 2 bunkers. One in Nantucket and the other on Peanut Island off the coast of Florida. Instead, this bunker was intended for the entirety of Congress. The hideout boasted more than 1,000 bunk beds, 110 urinals, a 400-seat cafeteria, individual auditoriums for both the Senate and the House of Representatives, vast water tanks, and a trash incinerator that could also serve as a crematorium.
Okay, I really want to watch the Survivor reality show of our current...
Heck yeah.
bunk beds, you guys are sleeping all in the same room. You guys are all... Let's see it. I'm ready.
Yeah, yeah. Pelosi started a gang. Everybody's like roving the halls.
Why won't anybody sleep next to Marjorie Taylor Greene?
Aw. But the thing about building something like this is you have to maintain it. You know, keep the light bulbs fresh, rotate the canned food every couple of years. And there was actually an entire dummy company called Forsyth Associates, which was supposedly a group of AV guys that serviced all of Greenbrier's televisions, but was actually there to maintain the bunker. And this went on for 35 years, with basically every employee being able to point directly at the blast door entrance that had been hidden under floral wallpaper and the outside world knowing nothing about it. Until, in 1992, a couple of reporters got a tip. One of them was Ted Gupp from the Washington Post, and the other was an unnamed staff writer for the Washington Times. And within days of each other, they both posted full exposés on the existence of the bunker and all the details behind it.
Ooh.
And congressional leaders at the time put out a statement saying, basically, we wish you hadn't done that because, quote, it was always clear that if the secret of the facility's location were to be compromised, the effectiveness and security of the program would be jeopardized, if not terminated. And the identity of the tipster has never been revealed. But the general understanding is that it was someone in the federal government who didn't like that money was being spent to maintain a nuclear bunker in the post-Cold War era. And indeed, when the story broke, the people of Greenbrier were upset that their cover had been blown. But the rest of the country seemed to be in agreement with the anonymous tipster. Politicians came under fire not only for spending taxpayer dollars on an outmoded bunker, but also for the very idea of saving Congress while ordinary citizens were left to die in the fallout. The good news is that once the secret was out, the government didn't need the bunker anymore. So the staff at Greenbrier were able to turn it into a tourist attraction, offering tours of the bunker to anyone who wanted to see it. Greenbrier employee Trish Parker says that when people come to see the bunker, they always ask if there's still another secret bunker below this one, because revealing the secret would be the perfect double bluff, right? She says, quote, "It would be lovely if there was, but there's not." Wink. Like, of course that's what she's going to say. We've already established this town is really good at keeping a secret, so.
Yeah, but the engineering difficulty of a silo within a silo, bunker within a bunker.
Well, and I mean, it may be that they had already built that part of it. They just didn't reveal all of it. They're like, you got us. There's a one-story deep bunker. Oh, shucks, guys.
Oh, shucks. Yeah. The other story's for the Illuminati. Oh, yeah. Shoot. I said it. Damn it. Oh, you got me.
All right. Next link.
Next link.
From The Guardian. The United States, get ready and brace yourself for cicadas by the trillions, because we've got not just one, but two broods of periodic insects that are dropping this year. Now, the last time they did a double headliner like this was when Thomas Jefferson was president. So it's been a really, really long time.
Wow.
But at least one person is super stoked. That would be Catherine Dana, an entomologist who specializes in cicadas at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Quote, "It's really exciting. I've been looking forward to this for many years. For the public, it's going to be a really special experience." Uh-huh. So we will see Brood XIX. They are the largest of all periodical cicada groups, and they've been dormant underground for 13 years, sipping on plant sap. It will also happen at the same time as Brood X3, a smaller group that appears every 17 years. And we are going to see trillions of cicadas pop up in as many as 16 states, from Maryland to Oklahoma, from Illinois to Alabama. Go online to see if the tour is going to be making a stop in your area.
It's like a typical world tour. It's America and maybe some Australia.
It is not just me making this festival illusion. The phenomenon, which has been dubbed Cicadapalooza, is going to make a ton of noise. In fact, their songs collectively can be louder than a revving motorbike.
Wow.
Now, the two broods may only overlap slightly in a small area. So if you're in central Illinois, get ready. So you are not going to see a larger than normal boom in numbers in any one place. But
okay,
if you're still really freaked out, our cicada specialist has something to say. "I'd like to remind people that this is a natural wonder of the world. You just don't see this biomass of terrestrial life anywhere else. There are several theories as to why cicadas do this, among the most popular being that an overwhelming surge of the creatures ensures that a good number will survive predators to spawn the next generation."
Mm.
Now, cicadas are not harmful to people or pets, but some have been found to expel jets of urine when threatened. So just, you know, don't threaten them. Let them do their thing.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, the noise is the problem.
It is.
I mean,
yeah.
They're not cicadas, but we have stuff in Texas that all night long in certain summertime months. It's so loud. I can't even imagine how bad it's going to be.
Wait a minute. We don't have cicadas?
I don't think so. There's something else, but they're out every year, so they can't be cicadas because the whole deal. Oh, no, I guess there are other species of cicada that don't go underground. You said
some are only summer periodical, some are just outside living their lives, and I've been calling them cicadas
for 40 plus years now, so
they're just the things that make noise and make me angry in the summer. Like, I don't know.
Well, central Illinois, you're gonna have to let us know, but for now, the article recommends, quote, "Sit back and be in awe of the spectacle. It will be over soon enough. And then think about where you will be in 13 or 17 years.
Yeah, and don't buy real estate in Illinois. That's my takeaway.
Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from sciencealert.com, and it's titled "Mysterious Link Between Cats and Schizophrenia is Real, Study Finds."
Huh. Oh, wait. Like having cats and being schizophrenic. Schizophrenic cats. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, that's correct. So I will preface any premature concerns just to say that this is a meta study and not all the studies are high quality, but there is a little something here. So Australian researchers conducted an analysis of 17 studies published during the last 44 years from 11 countries, including the US and the UK. We found an association between broadly defined cat ownership and increased odds of developing schizophrenia-related disorders, explained psychiatrist John McGrath and fellow researchers in their study published last December. The idea that cat ownership could be linked to schizophrenia risk was proposed in a 1995 study with exposure to a parasite called Toxoplasma gondii suggested as a cause, but the research so far has put forth mixed conclusions. To get a clearer picture, McGrath and his team say there's a need for a thorough review and analysis of all the research on these topics. T. gondii is a mostly harmless parasite that can be transmitted through undercooked meat or contaminated water. A bite from an infected cat or the feces of an infected cat can also transmit T. gondii. Once inside our bodies, T. gondii can infiltrate the central nervous system and influence neurotransmitters. The parasite has been linked to personality changes, the emergence of psychotic symptoms, and some neurological disorders, including schizophrenia. The team explains, after adjusting for covariates, we found that individuals exposed to cats had approximately twice the odds of developing schizophrenia. There are some important things to keep in mind here, like the fact that 15 of the 17 studies were case control studies, and this kind of research can't prove cause and effect. One study found no significant association between owning a cat before age 13 and later developing schizophrenia, but it did find a significant link when narrowing down cat ownership to a specific period, ages 9 to 12, which this inconsistency just suggests that the crucial time frame for cat exposure is not clearly defined yet. A study in the U.S. involving 354 psychology students didn't find a connection between owning a cat and schizotypy scores, but those who had received a cat bite had higher scores when compared to those who had not. But they suggested other pathogens such as Pastorella multicida may be responsible instead. So it's a little bit of a, hey, we found something, but we're going to brand it up a little bit more so that it sounds like more of a something. But I mean, that stuff with cat bites, you know, that's pretty legit. Like, that sounds real.
Yeah. I mean, I can definitely see a scenario of like, okay, the type of person who's going to develop schizophrenia is a cat person as opposed to a dog person. And you say, okay, they're exposed in childhood. The kid didn't choose that. But there's also some genetic components. So like if your mom is a cat person, you're more likely to have a cat growing up and you're more likely to develop schizophrenia because she's got some of those genes in there. I'm just saying you don't necessarily know the cats are causing any of this.
Yeah.
But it is bad to get bitten by a cat. That's not fun. Yeah. Who wants that?
Yeah. But I mean, on the flip side, we do know that toxoplasmosis can cause in mice, for instance, it makes them docile and just very chill around cats so cats can eat them. And there's been, I believe, some past studies saying that, you know, human beings in particular are influenced to, I think, just be nicer to cats or just have different behaviors. I don't think this is like conclusively studied, but toxoplasmosis definitely affects behavior in mice and may have effects on behavior in human beings. So it's kind of tough to say, right?
Like, or it's the early Batman where it's not the one thing, it's the combination of three or four. Because I also know somebody who had schizophrenia who didn't have a cat.
Yeah, I also know someone with schizophrenia who didn't have a cat. But like they said, you could be exposed, who knows? Knows where. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be your personal
cat. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't guarantee you that that friend of mine didn't get bit at some point in time between the ages of 9 and 12.
By a radioactive cat.
I don't know that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, if you had a cat from the ages 9 to 12 and your parents were mugged in an alley in a highly crime-ridden city, maybe go to the doctor instead of donning the cat mask.
Right.
There's already a superhero for that. They got it covered.
Your corrupt boss actually pushed you out of a window. We've all seen it. Yeah, we know how to.
You die, you get brought back to life. Yeah, go see a doctor.
Next link?
Next link.
I got pretty shorty here. And this story talks about something that, to be honest, I might have done had the opportunity or the courage. This comes from The Guardian. German art museum fires worker for hanging his own painting in the gallery.
He gets an applause over here for that one.
Yeah, for the audacity. A for audacity.
Exactly. At Munich's Pinakothek, the modern museum earlier this year, one technician and aspiring artist got to bask in the limelight for a whole 8 hours. The museum in southern Germany on Tuesday confirmed that it had fired a member of its technical services team after he was found to have hung one of his own paintings in a part of the gallery dedicated to modern and contemporary art.
Hey, at least he picked the right section, right?
Well, I don't know what he painted, but where it sat next to works by Andy Warhol for an entire day. The 51-year-old man had smuggled in his work and put it on display in the hopes of achieving his artistic breakthrough. But they haven't released his name, so it backfired a bit. Mm-hmm. We'll see. We'll see. I'm sure we'll find out soon. He'll go public with it. Or maybe that's part of the law.
This is the whole viral campaign to build suspense.
In his role at the museum, the man had access to the gallery space outside opening hours. And so it didn't raise the attention of security staff when installing his 60 centimeter by 120 centimeter artwork. So that's 2 by 4 inches.
Oh, it's tiny.
No, it's bigger than that. It's not. No, what?
Wait, 60 centimeters?
I don't know. Here's what I know. I'm glad that you went first, because my next article was a follow-up from later in the week on this exact same story, and they have a picture of the picture now.
Oh, so okay. I've seen yeah, it's bigger than 2x4.
Yeah,
okay.
No, well, 2x4 inches. It's like a normal-sized painting.
Okay, they definitely put it in wrong in the article. There were a few typos in this article.
Mm.
So, yeah, I guess bigger. And they didn't say in the article what it was, so I'm actually curious.
Oh, it's basically a family of four that are standing in a line, walking together, holding hands. But the key is the body parts have all been painted white to blend in with the background. So it's just the clothing. But then also the parents, the mom and the dad, have no pants. So it's really like these children holding up floating jackets. I don't know. Look, I'm not an art critic. It didn't speak to me, is all I'm saying.
Right. And what I was assuming it was, honestly, they said the museum was not commenting on the subject's painting. So I assumed it was a penis, honestly.
Yeah, no, when they first came out with all of this, everyone was like, what was it? And they're like, we won't say. And they kind of Streisanded affected themselves, because the story blew up. Everyone's like, we want to know what the painting was, which is why they finally relented just a couple days ago and showed the picture. But they still aren't naming the guy. That hasn't changed.
Ah, got it. Okay. Yeah, because he's also being investigated because he drilled 2 holes in the gallery wall to put it up. Whoops. Yeah, no blue tack. So I guess, yeah, be on the lookout for that painting. I'm sure he'll make it an NFT at some point in time. Are they still doing those? Those are still a thing, right?
I hope not. I wish not. All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include The Neuroscience of Creative Bliss, San Francisco Woman Describes Tow Truck Trying to Nab Her Moving Car, and Viruses Finally Reveal Their Complex Social Life. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at Patreon.com/DamnInteristingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.